Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Susan Rogers, a cognitive neuroscientist and award-winning professor at Berklee College of Music, and a multi-platinum record producer. She and Ogi Ogas have written a book that we're continuing our conversation about. This is What It Sounds Like: What the Music You Love Says About You. Susan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again about this book.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me back on. It was such a great conversation, at least for my part.
It was for my part, too. My problem is your book, and this makes it a great science book, generates hundreds more questions than the ones that you answered. And it's like, yeah, I know, but it's like, I want you to do all these experiments and like research. Because, you know, I want to know things like, why does your taste in music change as you get older, or does it? What happens to your taste in music and what you want to listen to throughout the day? You don't have any answers to that, right?
Well, it's still being investigated, and that's why we have this sub-discipline of music perception and cognition with all these various branches. So folks like Adrian North is looking at the social psychology of music, and a lot of folks have tried to link our personalities with our music taste, but it's a bit more complicated than an easy equation would allow. So my hunch is that as we get older, our brains are still seeking the same treats. We still want the kind of complexity that we enjoyed. We want the sort of lyrical a prose style that we enjoyed all our lives. There are certain grooves that we like all our lives, but we're expanding and we're willing to try out new musical artists.
But not everybody does that.
Same treats.
Not
everybody does that.
Because I'm not going to mention names, but I have a lot of people when I was the head of the rock department back in the late 70s through the 80s. And those people are still sort of stuck in that taste of music. Whereas I go, yeah, I still love that music, but I tried a lot of other stuff, and I love that too. And it's always amazing to me how reticent they are to try to listen to things. Like rap made no dent on them whatsoever, which I think was like avoiding an entire genre of music is pretty bad. But that's an interesting thing that happens with a lot of people. They get stuck in like a time warp.
Yeah, but it makes sense when we think about other modalities, like food, for example.
Yep.
Some people are very much meat and potatoes, at least maybe from our generation they were. You'd have a meat and a potato and a vegetable on your plate. And for them, that's food. It solves the problem. There's no need to think about it or look any further. There's no need to go to a restaurant that serves food that you've never had before or unfamiliar with. That would be aversive to a lot of folks, whereas for others, they got rewarded in the past for experimenting with food. And so when you say to them, let's try out this, fill in the blank, this new kind of restaurant, they'll say, yeah, that sounds good. They're anticipating that they're going to find a reward. So for all of us, we divvy up our motivations to allow us to get the things we want the most. For some of us, music is near the top of the list. We need that.
Yep.
For others, it might be sports, it might be fashion, it might be a social life, it might be any number of things, but not necessarily music.
Well, that brings up the idea of comfort food. So there will be always that music that you return to at times when you just want to chill out or not think about anything.
Exactly, yeah. Comfort music. We've all got it.
So what's your number one comfort piece of music?
Oh, golly gee. It's hard to get any better than Al Green from Sly Stone.
Okay.
Yeah, Sly Stone is another one. That's kind of my home base, and I can always go to those records, and it's just like wrapping yourself in a blanket psychologically.
Now, to review for people who missed our first interview, you talk about seven dimensions of music, and everybody has a different mix of these dimensions to find that their sweet spot. But the seven dimensions were authenticity, realism, novelty. Now, all those are in the music itself. And then the next four are things that are within ourselves: novelty, melody, lyrics, rhythm, and timbre. And I wanted to start talking about authenticity, because that I found it really, really interesting that you picked the Shags as a great example. And I love the Shags. And I want you to talk about people who have never even heard of the Shags, talk about who they were and then why people appreciated their music.
So the Shags were three sisters who lived with their family in rural New Hampshire in the 1960s. And the family didn't have a lot of money, but Dad was of the belief that his three daughters were destined for musical greatness. Now, this was quite a stretch, because the girls didn't play instruments and they didn't show any tendency toward music. But he hooked them up with some musical instruments, bass, drums, and guitar, and kind of commanded them to stay locked up in their room and learn to write and play. He forbade them from seeing boys. And I read that he took them out of school. It was pretty rough.
Wow. This sounds almost like child abuse.
Yeah, I think we would call it that today. So these three teenage girls, Betty, Helen, and Dorothy, they flailed away at their instruments, and they gave it their best shot, writing these pop songs that were similar to the Beach Boys and the kind of music that was popular in the 60s. And then Dad figured out, well, they've got so much talent, let's get them into the recording studio. So he brought them down to a studio in Revere near Boston and recorded 12 songs that became the album Philosophy for the World.
Yeah.
When the recording engineers heard the Shags play, according to one of the engineers who was present, he said, "We rolled on the floor laughing. I mean, it was outrageously bad, really bad, not in tune, not in time, as if you had taken, I don't know, a squirrel and put a squirrel on the drum kit and let a chimpanzee flail away at some chords. It sounds a little bit like that. But the lyrics have a gentle and poignant simplicity
right.
to them. I'm so happy when you're near. I'm so sad when you're away. Now that you're here, I'm happy every day." So the reason the Shags are important to folks in the music business is that they are the equivalent of a child's finger painting. There's zero technique. But what there is in the finger painting is intentionality. The little toddler is trying to say with this drawing, "This is my world. This is mom and dad. This is my house. This is my dog. This is me." It's an outward expression of yourself. So the Shags have no artifice whatsoever. They have no agenda. They're not going to be rock stars. But we can hear in their attempts to play music, we can hear intentionality in its purest form. And that's authenticity. It's a capacity to get on the microphone, get on your instrument, and communicate and say something. When we hear music that's perfect in pitch and time and execution but has no soul, they're missing something that the Shags have, and that's important.
How do we as a human, as a, recognize this? I mean, what you're talking in the case of the Shags is what some people would call naive. It's heartfelt, mm-hmm. but it's not professional. Yet in the same chapter, you talk about Sebastian Bach as an example of authenticity.
Yeah.
And that's a totally different, you know, experience listening to Sebastian
right.
Bach, but it's still authentic.
Yes. And I also mentioned Ella Fitzgerald and
yeah.
Frank Sinatra as well. So there was a scholar named Friedrich Schiller who wrote about these two poles of naivety and sentimentality. He was writing about classical music, but it can apply to anything. So we all start out naive, like the little child with the finger painting or the Shags. We don't know anything. We don't have any technique. And as we learn technique on our musical instruments or our voice, we progress towards sentimentality, which doesn't mean syrupy or maudlin. It means you have learned so much technique, you can express any sentiment, any emotion with your hands or your voice. Now, Schiller points out that this isn't just a unidirectional path. You don't just go from naivety to sentimentality. You've got to turn around and walk your way back. So once you have all that technique, you have to walk back to the impulse that made you want to make music in the first place. You have to become naive again, and you have to express yourself musically the way a 3-year-old would if he could, or the way a 97-year-old would if a 97-year-old could. So when we're listening to music, sometimes we can, well, we're pretty good at it. We can actually tell the difference between a singer who's feeling it and one who isn't. So you listen to Ella Fitzgerald, perfect technique. She's a maestra of technique. You can't get better than that. Yet Ella had soul. We can feel the weight of her life behind that voice. Same thing with Frank Sinatra. And this is why these artists are so revered, because they hit both of those poles. The pure, naive intentionality and the perfect technique. So Bach and Beethoven, they had soul. They had soul. But if you were to hear Bach performed, or Beethoven, a piece performed by conservatory musicians who were just reading the page, it would sound vapid. It wouldn't touch you at all. So our musical love is more than just hitting the right notes. There needs to be intentionality behind it, and listeners can detect it.
Give me some more examples of inauthentic records. When I was thinking about the subject, I was thinking about, there are all these wild recordings like Ethel Merman singing disco, or William Shatner singing rap. He did a rap version of the Julius Caesar. They were horribly inauthentic, yet we could still enjoy them out of what, novelty?
I think so. Sometimes the idea of something is worthy, even though the execution is poor. So that's why there's more than one dimension.
That's right.
For musical enjoyment. I love authenticity. I love that below the belt gut feeling that I get from many musical performances. If that is absent, there's still other ways for me to get a treat. I might just appreciate the construct or appreciate the idea that I've got a high regard for novelty in my music choices. So if something is just novel enough, I might say, yeah, that's cool. It's not going to be my go-to record, but I'll appreciate it.
Well, you talk about in the book, for you, the Rolling Stones versus the Beatles. And it struck a chord with me. When I grew up in my house, we only had Rolling Stones albums. We never had a Beatles album from my two older brothers. And so I grew up with all the early Rolling Stones records and thinking they were fantastic.
Oh, so good.
I know, and you talk about that the Beatles, were pop, and there's a lot there in other dimensions, but for authenticity, early Rolling Stones can't be beat.
Yeah, I experienced a really embarrassing moment when I first moved to Boston to teach at Berkeley. I was at a dinner party and sitting across from the dean of our department, and the subject was the Beatles at this party, and I mentioned told the truth. I said, the Beatles never really did it for me. I was more into fun.
Whoa,
The dean just stopped eating, and I could feel him just staring at me. And the conversation went on, and finally he said, I think you're faking it. You're saying that just to be cool. And I was really gobsmacked. I said, why would anyone do that? I was just telling the truth. The truth is, yesterday and today, the Beatles have never touched me in the way the Stones do. That's like saying I prefer, salty snacks to sweet snacks.
Right.
No one chooses that. You're merely expressing what neural assemblies have decided work for you. So, yeah.
Well, that has to do with the way the pop is appreciated within our culture, too. It's like sacred. And so for you to say that you like the Rolling Stones more than the Beatles, people probably thought you were just being genuinely, irascible.
Yeah, or trying to get attention. And that's a little bit irritating, because why would you do that?
Yeah.
And it's also presuming, and this gets me worked up, it's presuming that we curate our taste in music based on what we think other people are going to think of us.
Right.
And I can't think of anything that is less true. Don't we all, those of us who really love music, we love it because we're thoughtful and we are enamored of some pieces or not others. That it would almost be like suggesting you chose your romantic partner based on someone who looked good on paper. It doesn't work that way. There are forces beyond your control that are causing you to be attracted to one object or person and not another.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Susan Rogers, a cognitive neuroscientist, an award-winning professor at Berklee College of Music, and a multi-platinum record producer. You've got such a great resume. She and Ogi Ogus have written, I think, one of my favorite books of the year. This is What It Sounds Like, What the Music You Love Says About You. I think of those seven, I think one of the toughest concepts for me to grasp is timbre, spelled T-I-M-B-R-E. And as a matter of fact, I think most people aren't familiar with the word at all. It seems to me the most abstract concept of the seven, the most enigmatic, the hardest to characterize in words, but you do a good job of it. Let's talk about timbre.
Timbre is hard to characterize in words. You have to kind of hear it. So what timbre refers to, it's the tone color, the tone quality of a musical instrument. So you're in the recording studio, and you're going to put on the main guitar part. You got to choose a guitar, and you got to choose an amp, because the timbre matters. Is it going to be a Stratocaster? Will it be a Les Paul? Will it be a Telecaster? How distorted will it be? Clean or dirty? Are you going to use any effects pedals? All of these choices contribute to the unique acoustic profile of that instrument. It's like, in a certain sense, it's like casting actors, I suppose, in a movie or a TV show. Who's gonna fulfill this role? Who's going to convey this idea with the most authenticity and force, and who's gonna complement our other actors? So, for example, you've cast a mobster picture, and this is the mobster. Who should the mobster's wife be? What's believable here? So, likewise with timbre, you lay down that main guitar part. Now you have to add a harmony guitar part. So what timbre should you choose? You want to choose a sound that shades the main sound that you've just laid down. So you're gonna be listening for a hollowness, a brightness in the tone. You are picking out your acoustical colors the same way a chef would pick out the herbs that are going to season a soup or a stew that they've just come up with. These things go together, and collectively they convey a message. So timbre is enigmatic. I took a whole graduate level seminar on it when I was in grad school. Pitch, we can notate music on a score. You can draw the notes, and those are the pitches that you're going to play. And the spacing of the notes tells you, well, this is the timing. It's going to be legato or staccato, and you've got a time signature there. This is going to be where the bar ends. This is our time signature. You can denote rhythm, melody, and lyrics. You write the words down, but you can't denote timbre. You got to get in the studio or the rehearsal space and choose your instruments to decide which combination is going to be most effective.
The first example I thought of, I had just covered a biography of King Curtis, saxophone player, and he talked about his sax playing on, especially working with the Coasters. On Yakety Yak, he takes a really long sax break, and he calls it like chicken scratching, the way that he approaches his sax work. But it's totally unique. It's him. That the way that he makes the sax work is really his sound.
And yes.
That would be an example of timbre, right?
Yes, and don't you just love that? Dexter Gordon on saxophone.
Yeah.
I mean, oof. And you instantly recognize Charlie Parker. There's something about the way he interacts with the instrument. He pulls tone out of it in a way that is his, we call it a sonic signature.
Huh.
So the more advanced a musician is, or a record producer, the more clear their sonic signature becomes, to my ear, I can hear Jimmy Page's guitar tone, and it doesn't matter which guitar he's playing. It could be a Dan Electro, or it could be a Les Paul. It doesn't matter. His fingers have a way of interacting with the instrument that he pulls a certain tone out of it. Prince's guitar tone was modeled after Carlos Santana. Prince loved Santana's tone, and with his own fingers, he imitated that tone until his unique style could emerge from that. We know that in the recording studio, you know that there's really no point in having the assistant engineer before the session pick up an instrument and play it so that you can EQ it before the band comes in. There's no point, because as soon as that musician comes in and picks up that instrument, the tone of it is going to completely change.
I like you relate in the book that Prince called it more sauce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the more sauce on a sound. That swings. I understand that.
Yeah, just put a little bit more sauce on that. And yeah, you know what it means. And I had this guitar player once in the studio. I was mixing his record, and he said, "Can you make my guitar sound more R? Yeah, I can. What he means is more guttural, more throaty. Put more rasp on it. All right, then, we can do that. But that's the enigma of timbre. It's very hard to describe. You really kind of have to hear it.
Now, you said you write that timbre is a potent catalyst for memories. How and why?
Yes, because of these sonic signatures that we've talked about, a tone, a timbre, is going to be associated with the person who made it famous. So if you're going to hear a Gibson ES-355 guitar, if that pops up on your radar, odds are good that tone is going to evoke perhaps a memory of B.B. King, of the person who made that tone famous. So that's going to set, on some very subliminal level, some expectations that this guitar performance better be damn good. So if you hear the unmistakable drum sound produced by John Bonham of Led Zeppelin,
yeah,
if engineers and producers manage to capture that sound, you better nail it, son, because when we hear that tone, we expect that it's going to be great. We form these associations. Our brains learn to recognize patterns of neural activity and associate them with objects out there in the world. So timbre is really good at evoking memory if a certain sound has become iconic, like you mentioned, the saxophone sound of King Curtis. It's iconic.
Yeah. You, in the book, you have this strange case of Mr. B and Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire. What an interesting story that is. Can you talk about that?
Oh, such an interesting story. So this was a fellow in the Netherlands. He was 59 years old, and the poor man had a really bad obsessive-compulsive disorder. It was ruining his life, and he was anxious all the time. Now, he went to his doctors, and his doctors finally were able to perform a surgery that could help alleviate this OCD. Now, prior to his surgery, he liked music well enough. He liked the Beatles and the Stones, and he's Dutch, so he liked some native music from his country, but he didn't have a special fondness for music. Anyway, the surgeons implanted these four electrodes in a circuit called the nucleus accumbens. Uh-huh. Nucleus accumbens is really important to music perceptions because it mediates, it's involved in approach and retreat behavior, and it fires up when we approach new music that we like and are rewarded by it. So that nucleus accumbens is important to our love of music. Anyway, they implanted these electrodes in his nucleus accumbens, and shortly after his surgery, well, he reported to his doctors he was Mr. B 2.0. He felt great. The anxiety was gone. The OCD was gone. It was great. Then he was listening to the radio one day, and Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire came on. And he realized music had never sounded this good before.
Wow.
Ever.
Wow.
And he became kind of obsessed with Johnny Cash. He collected all of the Johnny Cash records he could find, and he listened to only Johnny Cash. And he told his doctors, there's a Johnny Cash song for every situation. he didn't listen to anything else. So The difference here was, and you might think, well, his OCD returned, right? No, no, no. He didn't feel any anxiety if he couldn't listen to Johnny Cash. He didn't feel any compulsion. But listening to Johnny Cash was intensely pleasurable. There was no other sound that mattered to him. So what this tells us is that our brain has decided or is deciding what timbres it likes. Now, Mr. B is an extreme case, but we're all doing this on a smaller level. We know what sounds we like, and we're gravitating toward those records that feature those sounds.
We're almost out of time. We just have literally a few minutes left, but timbre also is important in the sound of the human voice. And of the many things I've learned in your book, women with sexy voices have more sex than women with sexy bodies.
Mm-hmm. That's
but what about Sarah what about men? what about radio announcers?
I can tell you a little bit about that. So,
well, we don't have that much time. We have like 2 minutes left. If you can do it in 2 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, women do have preferences. It changes with their menstrual cycle, but they have preferences for male voices.
They do.
As Sarah Collins discovered in her work, she said, "Yeah, but the preference the." The reason for the preference is unclear because the preference doesn't seem to correlate with a man's weight or height or wealth or things like that. But we've got our preferences. We like what we like.
Well, that's why there's always a breakdown between if you listen to a radio announcer of any sex and then you finally meet them face to face, it's often a huge letdown.
I thought you were going to say it goes in the opposite direction. They're always greater than what you think their voice is.
No, that's never the way. That's that people create all sorts of images based on your sound, your timbre, and then when they meet you, no. Go ahead.
We humans have evolved to regard the human voice as the most important by a long shot sound in our world. So we make automatic decisions about the health and the wealth and the physical attributes and the availability of a person we're speaking with based on the timbre of their voice.
There's so much more we could be talking about this book. We could talk for years. My returning guest tonight is Susan Rogers, a cognitive neuroscientist, award-winning professor at Berklee College of Music, and a multi-platinum record producer. And she and Ogie Ogas have written, I think, an amazing book called This Is What It Sounds Like, What the Music You Love Says About You. Susan, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Mark, so much. I really appreciate you having me back on the show. And I'm grateful and I wish you luck with the program.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night. Thank you.